For many years, sushi enjoyed only bi-coastal popularity in this country. Nowadays, you can find it practically anywhere in America. But are Americans eating it the right way? In fact, is there even a right way? In his latest book, Trevor Corson, who's lived for 3 years in Japan, explores the differences between sushi, the way it has been classically eaten in Japan, and the way Americans consume it, by following Kate Murray, a 20-year-old woman who studied at the California Sushi Academy. The Zen of Fish, the story of sushi from samurai to supermarket, is published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased it has brought Trevor Corson back to my show today. Hello.
Hi, it's great to be back here with you.
So is there a right way to eat sushi?
Well, sushi has been in constant evolution over a long time, both in Japan and the U.S. But I do provide some tips for sushi bar etiquette because there are definitely a lot of things that we in the U.S. do wrong, not because it's some sort of, you know, authentic style or way you have to eat, but because it actually inhibits your ability to enjoy the food.
Well, Japanese have told me that they get upset when the gaijin, that's the foreigners, scrape their chopsticks together after they pull them apart.
That's a minor insult.
But then we immerse a piece of sushi into soy and wasabi paste. They just dunk it right in, and it sucks up all of that stuff in the rice. They say that's really not to be done. Why?
That's the larger insult to the chef, because I found this out as I started talking to sushi chefs in the U.S. And since I spoke Japanese, they tended to be fairly forthright with me. And a lot of them told me, you know, I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to the fish market and get a really, really nice fish. And the thing about all that wasabi and soy sauce is that it really overwhelms the flavors of fish. I talk in the book a bit about the science of why flesh fish is so interesting to eat raw. And it's a very subtle experience.
Well, they also are putting a little bit of wasabi on the rice, aren't they, in many of the sushi? So they feel that they have given us all we need?
That's exactly right.
And then you dip a little bit in the soy then?
Yeah, and there are various ways to do that. The preferred thing is to dip the fish part of we're talking about nigiri, those little packs of rice with a slice of fish on top. And the preferred thing to do is to dip the fish in the soy sauce, just a little corner of it. If you dip the rice in the soy sauce, the rice will fall apart unless the chef squeezes it really tightly. And that's a shame, because good sushi should just melt apart in your mouth.
Is sushi in Japan very different than what we get here?
Well, yes. American sushi on the whole tends to be defined by sushi rolls. And sushi rolls are really not a big part of sushi in Japan. Sushi in Japan really focuses more on the nigiri. And that is actually also just a particular style of sushi in Japan that dates back to the old Tokyo era. And there are many regional varieties of sushi throughout Japan.
And there are some rolls. There's the cucumber roll.
Yes.
And chefs love to show off their knives by slicing the cucumber skin just so, maintaining exactly the right width and the right thickness.
Yes, exactly. There are all kinds of – in fact, there's even a comic book series in Japan I talk about where sushi chefs go up against each other in these dramatic displays of martial arts skills with their sushi swords. But the small, thin sushi rolls with one ingredient and some seaweed on the outside, those are traditional in Japan. And there's one other kind of larger roll that's traditional. The earliest sushi roll recipe in Japan dates from about the same year of the American Revolution, 1776, and that roll calls for the skin to not be seaweed, but interestingly, the skin of a poisonous blowfish.
Now, blowfish is something that gives you a little tingle, I gather, if you eat it correctly, but also can kill you if you haven't eaten it correctly.
it's really up to the chef as to how skilled they are. And the best chefs, because the poison is in certain parts, the liver, gonads, and the skin, I believe, and the best chefs apparently are able to leave just enough poison in the flesh to give you that tingling sensation without it killing you.
What's the best way to order sushi in a restaurant? Should you sit at the sushi bar?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I talk about in the book quite a bit in various ways, following these young chefs going through their training, the story that I write about, is that The sushi chef's job is very much a social one, as well as a one that involves food. And
so you know, talking is encouraged. If you can get the chef to talk.
Yeah, the chef is basically trained in a way to be not just a chef, but also kind of like a bartender. You know, to sit there and talk with customers. And I always encourage people to sit at the bar and not even to go, you know, try to find the best sushi restaurant that has the best fish, but just go to a restaurant where you feel comfortable with the chef and get to know the chef. And over time, getting to know the chef, he'll come to understand your preferences. And as he comes to value you more as a customer, he will start giving you his better cuts of fish.
Can you just simply say, show me what you have and I trust you?
Yeah, there's a variety of ways to go about it on my website. TheZenOfFish.com. I actually have a little page called How to Eat Sushi, and it goes through some of the approaches you can make to the chef and how it's done in Japan and in the U.S. and that kind of thing. And there's various ways, but you can basically come in and say, look, I'm not really sure what I want to eat. I don't know what you have today. What do you recommend? Could you recommend something? I'll tell you whether it sounds appetizing to me or not. You can even say, look, I have this X amount of money I want to spend today. Here's my budget.
Can you explain what omakase is?
Yeah, omakase is a Japanese word that means I leave it up to you. Mm-hmm. And this is the invitation for the chef to pull out his best stuff and show his chops and have fun and be not only a bit creative but also sort of give you the top-of-the-line meal. And you should be ready to shell out some serious money when you order omakase, but, you know, it's something that to do a couple times a year is quite an experience because you just never know what's going to happen. And that kind of surrendering to the chef is something that's hard for Americans to do because we're so used to ordering off menus, but it's a great experience.
When the bill comes, people are unsure as whether to tip the sushi chef separately, because you don't tip a chef under other circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I usually do tip the chef. And then, you know, the wait staff brings you drinks, so it ends up to be an expensive evening, but it's worth it to do occasionally.
Is it true that you're supposed to have your miso soup at the end of the meal?
Yeah, well, miso soup in Japan traditionally is usually eaten at the end of the meal because it's a digestive aid. There's a lot of active enzymes and stuff in good, real miso soup. So generally it's eaten at the end, not at the beginning.
And they've just turned it around because Americans like their soup at the beginning. The
Chinese
have done that as well. The Chinese usually have their soup at the end of a meal too.
Yeah, there's a lot that's changed as sushi became an American meal and arrived in this country. That's, you know, a good example of something small. Another example is how most of us tend to, even when we go out to eat sushi, sit at a table and order off a menu.
Another thing that you can spot very easily is that some restaurants are incredibly expensive and some are not. And I'm assuming that's because the less expensive ones are buying factory prepared sushi rice and then they're using lousier cuts of fish. Is that true?
Well, the fish,
they usually don't have as much flavor.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is that the demand is so high, especially for tuna, it's actually become hard to find tuna that tastes like much almost anywhere. To get really good tuna now, you've got to be willing to spend some serious money. And one of the things I try to do in the book is actually encourage people to try some of the other types of fish that are actually more traditional. Tuna, for a long time in Japan, was considered garbage fish. And so there are a lot of interesting experiences to be had with lighter, leaner flesh fish like flounders and snappers, which for a long time were considered the real kings of sushi. And there are certainly sushi places that don't make the effort to make their own rice, but rice is really the key. The more sushi I eat, the more I've been paying attention to the rice and how much it varies from one place to the next.
Don't the Japanese also order things that aren't with fish a lot more than Americans would?
Sure. The word sushi actually has nothing to do with fish at all. It refers to the rice. Again, it's rice that's been seasoned with a little tart vinegar and some sugar and some salt, and every good sushi bar has its own recipe. That's what defines sushi, is the rice, and all manner of toppings can go on there and still have it be considered sushi. And it's very interesting in the book. I trace the history of how this taste for this tart rice developed, and it's a very surprising history.
My guest is Trevor Corson, who lived in Japan for 3 years and speaks fluent Japanese. His previous book was The Secret Life of Lobsters, and now he's written a book called The Zen of Fish, The Story of Sushi from Samurai to Supermarket. It's published by HarperCollins. You said that the history is really interesting. It started off not as fresh fish?
That's right. It started off not even near the ocean. The origins of sushi go back to the area around northern Thailand, where rice farmers had freshwater fish, a seasonal supply of freshwater fish, and so they needed a way to preserve the fish. So they packed the fish in cooked rice. The rice would rot and become inedible, but it would create acids around the fish that would preserve the fish. And they could open this up to a year later and still eat this fish. It would be fermented, but it'd still be edible.
Like a thousand-year eggs.
Something along those
or
lines.
Head cheese.
Yeah, it was actually a kind of, you know, it was more akin to stinky cheese in its flavors than anything resembling fresh fish. But then what happened was, is this fish preservation method moved up through China and then over to Japan. If they didn't need to preserve the fish for as long, they started eating it sooner and sooner in this process. And if you ate it soon enough, the rice would still be edible, but it would have a kind of tart, fermented flavor to it. And that's where the appreciation for the tart rice, the combination of tart rice and fish, comes from. And then when rice vinegar was invented, then you could just use freshly cooked rice, splash in a little vinegar, put on some fish, and that came to be known as quick sushi. And it was a kind of a fast food snack.
And then there's sashimi, which doesn't have the rice. That's for people who just love the taste of the raw fish.
Yeah, in fact, sashimi is totally unrelated originally to sushi. It has nothing to do with sushi. That's its own tradition of eating raw meat. And sashimi started out as an aristocratic meal that could have included fish. There are reports that there was wild boar sashimi, maybe even crane sashimi.
Isn't most of the fish that ends up as sushi shipped frozen? Doesn't that destroy a certain amount of the structure of the cells?
Not necessarily anymore. The freezing technology has become so impressive nowadays. A lot of these tuna, as soon as they're caught, they're cleaned and they're immediately deep frozen in liquid nitrogen, which brings their temperature down to negative 70 degrees or something in a very short time, so fast and so cold that the water inside the muscles of the fish doesn't even have time to crystallize, so it doesn't break apart the flesh the way normal freezing does.
And then they also don't want to eat it the first day. If you can get a fresh tuna, you don't want to eat it the first day. Why is that?
Well, that was so funny because everybody thinks, oh, you know, you got to have the freshest fish for sushi. And as I looked into the science of fish flesh and the tradition of making sushi, it turns out that tuna, for example, were originally called in Japanese shibi. That was a nickname, which means 4 days, because you were supposed to bury a tuna in the ground for 4 days before eating it. And that's because fish flesh, raw fish flesh, actually needs time to develop flavor. The muscles have to break down to develop those molecules that create the wonderful flavors.
How many sushi chefs in the United States have been trained the way the Japanese are trained?
Very hard to say. When sushi started to explode here, starting in Hollywood in the late 70s, it became an opportunity for young Japanese men who didn't want to go through the standard 5-year apprenticeship in Japan to come over and become instant sushi chefs in America. And the demand for sushi in the U.S. has been so amazing and so widespread that there's no way we could be filling all these sushi chef positions if everybody went through that training. So this, in my book, I write about the California Sushi Academy, and that was partly established to come to a happy medium, you know, give students a basic training in a short amount of time that would allow them to make good sushi without having to go through the longer apprenticeship.
But if you don't make the sushi correctly, you can actually endanger your customers' health, can't you?
Yeah, you can. And that's actually one of the exact reasons that the guy who founded the Sushi Academy had for starting it, because he was afraid somebody was going to die sooner or later from eating sushi. But the risks are relatively small, considering that now, you know, you can get E. coli from your salad greens at your supermarket. But I do talk a bit in the book about, you know, the parasites that can come from raw fish. And, you know, it's scientifically fascinating to read about, if a bit unsettling.
The sushi chefs are always wiping off their knives, and they do have the most beautiful knives in the world.
Yeah, these knives are amazing. They go back to, the makers of samurai swords, who were outlawed from making samurai swords at a certain point in Japanese history, turned their attention to kitchen knives, and boy, they are probably the best knives in the world.
You followed the adventures of Kate Murray, 20, 21 years at the Sushi Academy. Is she typical of the students there?
Not really. I actually chose to focus on Kate because she had the hardest time. She had no cooking experience. She had no knowledge of Asia. But she was a great example of a typical American who had discovered sushi and fallen in love with it and had decided she was going to dedicate, you know, herself to becoming a sushi chef, which I just found incredibly admirable and interesting. And she had a very hard time. So she goes through a whole series of trials and tribulations and challenges along the way of, you know, learning to cut up fish and all this kind of stuff that she's never done before. And she's got a double whammy of discrimination against her because not only is she not Asian, she's a woman. And I talk in the book about what a male-dominated world sushi is.
So and she's not an Asian. She's a woman. And there are taboos in Japan about women eating sushi alone. So there are real taboos here.
Yeah, I was very surprised to discover it's not just hard to become a sushi chef, a female sushi chef in Japan. It's hard to go eat sushi as a woman unless you have a male companion, because a lot of these sort of patriarchal old-fashioned sushi chefs won't give you the time of day if you're a woman on your own in Japan.
How much of the class involved teaching the students how to put on a show for the customers?
Yeah, there was as we talked about before, there was a fair amount of teaching the chefs to interact with customers and how to recommend things to them that they might not otherwise try. And this was particularly interesting to me to realize that these young Americans, you know, Caucasians or whatever, who are becoming chefs actually might end up being better at recommending new and interesting traditional pieces of sushi for customers to try than Japanese chefs are, because a lot of Japanese chefs have just given up on American customers.
Well, they've given up on us because even eating raw fish goes against the conventional wisdom about American food tastes. Why do you think it's caught on as much as it has, whereas offal, which is really popular in Europe, and some other things that are popular in other parts of the world, never have caught on?
I suspect it has something to do with the fact that sushi seems extremely exotic and exciting to us, and yet at the same time, the fundamental flavor of it is very easy to take. And again, it's that rice. It's basically sweet and sour rice. There's a lot of sugar in it. So we had sweet and sour pork with the Chinese food invasion. Now we have sweet and sour rice.
Also, I suspect people think it's healthier than other kinds of cuisines, but it turns out it really isn't.
Yeah, that was sort of funny to look into. You know, we automatically assume sushi, healthy, so we get a free pass. But one example, I just went to a supermarket and I pulled out a frozen pizza and a California roll, and they had the same number of calories per serving. So that's indicative right there.
And as you said earlier, there's also some bacteria that might be on the fish.
Well, I worry less about bacteria because the freezing technology is so good and the system of distribution is so good for sushi fish now. But, you know, as with any of those fish, like tuna, the high-level predators, you do have to worry about mercury and PCBs.
It's also affected the American fishing industry. A lot of the East Coast fisheries, and the Reverend Sun Myung-moon got involved in this, are specifically fishing for the Japanese.
Well, they're specifically fishing for all of us now. I mean, you know, our appetite for sushi has gone completely global. The Japanese wiped out their local supplies of fish more or less decades ago, so they've had a global sushi trade for quite a while.
But they usually pick the best tuna, don't they?
They usually do.
Kind of auctions at the piers.
Yeah, yeah, the very best. But, you know, I was talking to a tuna distributor the other day who said, I'm having trouble getting the good tuna for my chefs in New York City because it's all going to Kansas City.
Did Kate have any trouble finding work as a sushi chef after
she did graduated? Yeah, at the end of the book, I describe her attempts to get a job in, you know, generally Asian-run sushi bars in the San Diego area where she now lives and works. And she had a very hard time. You know, I won't give away the ending, but she does persevere finally. And she is now currently a sushi chef working in San Diego at an all-white sushi bar.
Trevor Corson will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store in Chelsea. That's on 6th Avenue and 22nd Street. You might want to stop by. The book, Zen of Fish, The Story of Sushi from Samurai to Supermarket, is published by HarperCollins. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.